Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know what's worse than prices going up all the time? Prices not going up enough. Seriously, Jay Powell told me so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 21st day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To recap this macroeconomic moment, recapping because macroeconomic moments are what we do around these parts, things are overall all right. No less a figure than Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said so just yesterday. But all right overall means some things specifically aren't. Hence the Fed saying yesterday it's thinking it's not going to raise interest rates at all this year. So we are going to continue today with a bit of Powell parsing, something he said 35, 40 minutes into his 45-minute Q&A about inflation, or more accurately, the lack thereof. Inflation is currently and persistently a bit below the Fed's target level of 2%. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains the problem with a little too little inflation.
Worrying about too much inflation, that hasn't traditionally kept economists up at night, says Kevin Jakes. He's a finance professor at Baldwin Wallace University and a former economist at the Treasury Department.
Most of us have these preconceived notions of high inflation being problematic, like it wasn't if you go back and look at the late 1970s or the early 1980s.
When inflation ran into the double digits, to tame it, the Fed had to jack up interest rates, which put the U.S. economy into a recession.
So this whole idea that, hey, wait a minute, there can be problems from low inflation, that's really out of the traditional realm of what economics and policymakers have looked at over the decades.
But too little inflation isn't just a problem.
It's a major challenge. It's one of the major challenges of our time, really.
That's Fed Chair Powell at yesterday's press conference.
It gives central banks less room to respond to downturns.
This part gets a little technical, but lean on in. Recall that in a recession, the Fed can cut interest rates to try and stimulate the economy. Kevin Logan, chief U.S. economist at HSBC.
They like to lower the interest rate below the rate of inflation, and that encourages more borrowing, it enables people to pay back their debts more easily, and it provides some stimulus to economic activity.
Bottom line, low inflation makes that option less powerful.
It makes it less effective. That's really what they're concerned about.
And too low inflation has this self-reinforcing quality to it. When people and companies think inflation will remain low, they don't increase prices or wages. And that, in turn, keeps inflation low. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Today, President Trump declared parts of Nebraska a major disaster area. Floodwaters have inundated portions of the Midwest over the past week or so. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on TV. Best guesses put the damage so far at more than $1 billion. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is warning that this year could end up being worse than the great flood years of 93 and 2011. All of which is to say, some of the most productive agricultural land this country has is or might soon be underwater. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The floods have caused more than $800 million in damage to Nebraska agriculture so far.
Well, I've got 500 acres of ground underwater right now.
Scott Olson farms 3,000 acres of corn and soybeans in eastern Nebraska near the border with Iowa. He also sells farm equipment, and he expects to take a hit there, too.
It's awfully hard to go out and buy a newer piece of equipment when you know that your land is in peril. You've lost livestock, you've lost feed, you've lost your commodities like your corn or soybeans.
Which many farmers have, including potentially millions of tons of stored grain. Herds of cattle have died, and others are unreachable due to the flooding. Kevin Garvin is the emergency manager of Cedar County in northeast Nebraska.
The water was rather powerful. I mean, it just washed things away. There's portions of roads that you can't even tell there was a road there.
Garvin says many in his community are worried about how long it will take the water to recede.
If we can't get to the fields before the growing season, there's people that theoretically may not get a crop in this year, and that's going to be economically devastating to those farmers.
These floods will affect more than just agriculture in the Midwest, says David Swenson, an economist at Iowa State University.
Manufacturers aren't going to be producing product. Businesses aren't selling goods and services in the small communities.
And with more floods likely, it's unclear when they will be able to again. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this day after Fed Day. Jay Powell, who loves you, baby? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The opioid crisis in this country, and this is from the Centers for Disease Control, it kills 50,000 people a year. It is by miles the deadliest drug epidemic this country has ever seen. And for those stuck in it and for their families and for public health practitioners, it probably looks like there's no end in sight. But a look at history shows drug epidemics actually have a lifespan, a beginning, a middle, and eventually an end. For the past year, the team behind our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has been reporting out how they end. Chrissy Clark is the host of The Uncertain Hour. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So here we are with season what, three?
Yeah.
Season three. So this one is, it's not about the opioid epidemic, right? You start before this?
We go 30 years before the opioid epidemic.
Tell me about it.
So in 1989, President George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. the first President mm-hmm. Bush, pretty much turbocharged the war on drugs. And he used his very first televised speech from the Oval Office to focus on one thing and one thing only, the fact that drugs were tearing apart American society. Hmm. And he had a very bold plan to fight it. Listen to what he's saying.
Okay.
We need more prisons, more jails, more courts, more prosecutors. Hmm. So tonight I'm requesting altogether an almost $1.5 billion increase in drug-related federal spending on law enforcement.
I mean, it sounds kind of crazy to hear those mm-hmm. words now, right? Given the fact that there is large bipartisan agreement today that we have too many people behind yeah. bars in this country. And that's due in large part because of the drug war that Bush doubled down on in that speech in 1989.
And $1.5 billion sounds almost quaint, right? Just in today's dollars. You picked that moment, though, for a reason. What changed there?
So, launching after that speech, Bush would go on to spend more money on anti-drug efforts than Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan spent
wow.
during their administrations combined.
Wow.
So, $45 billion, and more than two-thirds of that money was focused on law enforcement. It's important to note that drug enforcement and law enforcement mm-hmm. around drugs is actually as much about economic theory as it is about punishment. And it all comes back to thinking about markets for drugs, like any other kind of market, one that is ruled by the forces of supply and demand.
All right, so explain that a little bit. Give me some for instances.
Okay, so there's an economic theory behind this tough on drug crimes approach, basically that if people are more likely to get arrested and sent to prison mm-hmm. for a long time for selling drugs, they'll stop selling drugs, or at least they'll charge more money for the drugs to compensate for the risk that they're facing. So in other words, by trying to restrict the supply of drugs, mm-hmm. you can, at least in theory, raise their price, Econ 101, and that would affect demand because the more expensive drugs are, the fewer people would use them. So at least that is the theory.
Well, right. And that's a great transition to my question, which is, no, come on, because as we all know, you know, economics is a really subjective thing. So tell me what actually happens.
Right. So in short, there's no good evidence to suggest that theory
right.
translated into what it was intended to do. If you look at the 80s and 90s, when the war on drugs was ramping up, when more law enforcement was on the streets, longer sentences were being handed out, the price of crack actually fell substantially, meaning that crack was easier to buy as the war on crack raged.
So what did, I'm sure you talked to, if this is even a thing, right, drug market economists?
Yes.
So what did they say?
So they said kind of the same thing that the former drug dealers that I talked to said. And I'll let Don Schatz, who grew up in D.C. and sold crack in the 1980s, I'll let him explain.
Okay. You know, when you out there doing crime, you don't look at, oh, I might get a lot of time if I sell these rocks. people wasn't looking at that, you know, because it's like everybody think they ain't gonna never get caught. Ain't nobody mm-hmm. gonna study the law and say, okay, I'm gonna look up this crime and see how much it carries if I do this. Nobody does that, you know.
Okay, so bring me now to today with opioids, right? 30 years later, different drug. What's going on, and are there new strategies and what people are thinking?
In some ways, yes. A lot of the policies that were put in place in the 80s, like the stiff mandatory mm-hmm. minimums for crack crimes, are finally beginning to be rolled back, like the First Step Act that Congress recently passed. But the reality is that people are still going to jail for petty amounts of drugs, for crack and for meth and for opioids. And I'll leave you with this sobering statistic about today. So since 1980, mm-hmm. our federal prison population has grown by 639%. Oh, man. And today, nearly half of those inmates are in for drug offenses. The overwhelming majority of them are people of color, mm-hmm. and the most common drug charge is low-level sales.
It's a podcast called The Uncertain Hour from Chrissy Clark on our Wealth and Poverty Desk, also Caitlin Esch. You'll hear out in the field doing some great reporting there.
Team effort.
I guess it's about how drug crises end, right? And we're talking crack and opioids and all that stuff.
That's the big question.
Thanks, Chrissy.
Thank you, Kai.
Season 3 of The Uncertain Hour starts today. Check it out and subscribe at uncertainhour.org. I got to tell you, I've heard most of this season, you guys. It's really good. There's some research out today in the Journal of Ethnic and Racial Studies about Asian Americans, specifically the children of Asian immigrants, and how, and I'm speaking broadly here, but how their academic accomplishments, Asian Americans have the highest percentage of college graduates of any minority group. They are overrepresented at Ivy League schools as well. But how those realities, those accomplishments, don't always translate into their professional lives. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Kathy Yen grew up in New York City. Her parents are from China and Taiwan. Yen did well in school and graduated from Barnard College with an economics degree. Then she moved to the Bay Area and had a series of accounting jobs, making one lateral move after another.
Kind of looking slowly for other opportunities, but it wasn't like, yeah, I'm definitely going to, if I stay here, I'll get to a management position.
Yen says many of her friends seemed to be kind of stuck, too. Clearly, something had been lost in the transition between school and work. In school,
you take a test or you write a paper and you do well, and it's a little bit clearer as to what you need to do to kind of reach a high level of achievement.
The workplace? Not so clear. Jennifer Lee is a sociology professor at Columbia University and one of the authors of the new study.
There is a severe labor market disadvantage for Asians.
Lee says Asian American white-collar workers are the least likely group to be promoted into management. And those who get there often have greater qualifications than their white counterparts.
There seems to be something that we suspect is operating to depress their promotion rates.
That something is a lot of things, actually. One is a lack of Asian American mentors in high positions. Another is culture. Rosa Fontana is the daughter of Korean immigrants. She grew up in Southern California and says at home and in school, she was expected to be,
you know, respecting authority and not really speaking out as much.
Fontana, now 47, graduated from Cornell, then went to work as an aerospace engineer.
That was really a challenge when I went into the workforce, just like speaking out and challenging things, you know, even participating in meetings and, you know, voicing ideas.
And in corporate America, says career counselor Jane Hyun,
from the perception of other colleagues in the room, they may be thinking, oh, this person is just a yes man.
Hyun runs workshops on leadership, culture, and diversity for Fortune 500 companies. She's also the author of Breaking the Bamboo Ceiling, which focuses on career strategies for Asian Americans. Strategies that are familiar to Goodwin Liu, a California Supreme Court justice. He says Asian Americans are the largest minority group in law firms, but have the lowest ratio of partners to associates.
Advancement is based not just on how many hours you bill or how hard you work, but also it's based on a lot of intangible things, including sociability, including leadership skills, including executive presence.
Lou credits his own success in part to having a mentor early on who taught him those skills.
Things that traditionally have not been formally taught.
As for Kathy Yen, she's now a project manager in global business intelligence at one of the world's biggest tech companies. She says she would have liked to get to this point earlier in her career, but she's there now, and that's fine. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's like the gold rush. Yeah, everybody just go there because the money is there.
With apologies to the bard, on this World Poetry Day, all that glisters is not gold. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 216 points today, 0.8%, 25,962. The NASDAQ up 109, 1.4%, 78.38. The S&P 500 advanced 30 points, about 1%, 28.54. So World Poetry Day. Here we go. Levi Strauss, the maker of jeans, yearned to be back in the market, it seems. Stonewashed, unwashed, ripped to vent with its IPO Levi's, zipped up 31.8%. A rose by any name might smell as sweet, but would an apple on Wall Street? Today, an announced new AirPod tech. Investors said, hey, Siri, check. Apple took the compliment. Its stock today up 3.67%. For Facebook, Emily Dickinson would have had no use because she was a poet recluse. But had she felt the need to post, she might have been perplexed to learn her password could be stored as readable plain text. Facebook still up 0.3%. It says password stayed inside its system that nowhere else did it list them. And you are listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want to tell you about another podcast from Marketplace. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This season goes deep inside the war on drugs because to understand how we've handled the opioid crisis so far, you need to go back in history, starting 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush held up an actual baggie of crack cocaine during his first national televised speech. There is, though, a strange backstory to where that baggie of crack came from, and it's a moment we've been dealing with ever since. The new season is out now. Listen and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Car companies like to use their safety records as selling points. No car maker more so than Volvo. The company's latest announcement, though, is interesting. It's going to try to prevent accidents by watching out for risky behavior from the human at the wheel. Volvo is going to make driver-facing cameras standard equipment inside all of its cars in the next few years, raising more than a couple of privacy and liability questions, as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports.
Modern cars are incredibly safe, but it's always better to prevent an accident altogether. Volvo's focus for doing that is now the driver.
Driver monitoring cameras allow the car safety to take action when necessary to keep people safe.
The company wants to start a conversation about whether car makers have the right or even obligation to install tech which can watch drivers. Attorney Jennifer Dukarski wonders about consent. What about the privacy of passengers?
It's going to be a Wild West show for a little while, trying to figure out how these new technologies are going to play out in the courts.
Expect to see more driver monitoring in the future because cars with semi-autonomous features need it. Cadillac already has a driver gaze tracking camera. Anuj Pradhan at the University of Massachusetts Amherst says systems which seem to handle all the driving can lull humans into a distracted state where they'll
engage in other secondary tasks like texting or reading or sleeping.
Driver monitoring could be reassuring, though, for that elderly parent who refuses to give up the car keys, for example. Volvo's system will eventually pull a car over and stop it. But Bryant Walker-Smith at the University of South Carolina says that raises questions over ultimate legal authority.
If someone is racing to a hospital and driving in a less than optimal manner, well, maybe we still want them to get to the hospital.
For context, 40,000 people die on U.S. roads every year, and over 90% of accidents are caused by humans. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We told you the other day about some changes coming to the H-2B visa program. The visa is used for seasonal workers in this economy. Today, another spoonful of the immigration alphabet soup with a look at the H-2B's cousin, the H-1B. Changes coming to that one, too. Remember, this is the program for highly skilled foreigners who fill jobs usually in technology, science, and engineering. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
The government is switching from a paperwork-heavy H-1B application process to an electronic one, and it created a pre-application. If applicants don't pass, there's no need to submit the more time-consuming and expensive full version.
It is impossible to imagine that the system that they are proposing will make things more efficient.
Sandra Feist is an immigration attorney in Minneapolis. She points out that the government got almost 200,000 H-1B applications last year and granted 85,000 visas, all the law allows. Feist says if you lower the bar for applying for an H-1B, what's going to happen is
more employers are going to submit registrations for less viable cases,
which she says will further clog the system. What many employers really want, though, is more employees. Richard Burke is CEO of Envoy Global, a firm that helps companies navigate the H-1B process. Envoy recently surveyed more than 400 companies that hire foreign workers. Burke says pretty much all of them are asking one question.
Shouldn't we have a greater number than 85,000 to issue under the H-1B program?
Opponents of upping the cap say those jobs should go to Americans. But David Beer at the Cato Institute says the labor market is so tight that there just aren't enough qualified workers in the U.S.
The idea that, you know, we should be keeping people out of the country is really putting a cap on economic growth.
And while President Trump has made growth a top priority, many companies say their inability to fill critical jobs with qualified foreign workers is capping their growth. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's a story about business, promise, and peril all rolled into one. The video game market in China is worth an estimated $30 billion a year. Promising, right? But as with many lucrative industries in China, foreign companies are only allowed in if they partner with a Chinese host, which can be perilous. One might imagine this clears the way for Chinese game developers, but one would be imagining wrong. Last year, Beijing stopped approving new mobile games for sale over there. Revenues for existing companies cratered. One analyst guessed that as many as 400 of them collapsed. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack spoke to one company still hanging on.
A fish tank sits in the office of LinkJoy, a game developer in Beijing. Company founder Tommy Yuan says it's good feng shui to have the fish and the water by the window.
Water is gold and gold is fortune, so...
So you put the fish tank in front of the window to attract the fortune.
Yeah.
Luck is partly why his firm is still standing today. Tommy Yuan started his company in 2013, when the mobile video game market was starting to grow in the double digits. There was less government oversight then.
It's like the gold rush. Everybody just go there because the money is there. So everybody, whether prepared or prepared not, they just go there. They try their luck.
Then in 2016, the government started imposing stricter rules to publish mobile video games.
Actually, we don't know exactly what the rule is.
Because he says regulators don't write down everything that is or isn't allowed in a game, and the criteria change every year. There are the obvious things he avoids, anything too violent, too sexual, or anti-government themes. But then there's his game Tiny Sailors. It's about sailing. Tommy Yuan says regulators asked him to cut out references to pirates, which he says surprised him. But he took out the word in the game's dialogue and submitted it again, and says the regulators asked him to make more changes.
When we get our permission of our games, we like back and forth like five or six times. So we modified a lot.
He says there is no way to dispute the official ruling. The approval process can take 2 to 6 months, which is a long time for the fast-moving market. Then last March, the permissions suddenly stopped without official notice.
Every month they got rumors where it will open next month.
And the industry was already going through a rough patch, he says. Many of his friends shut down their video game businesses because there were fewer new users, and the clientele and revenue collection models kept changing. They simply couldn't keep up.
Well, my friends, he killed himself. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry to hear that.
It's okay.
He says his friend was upset because he sold everything, including his apartment, and still couldn't save his company. The latest obstacle for the industry was the suspension of game approvals. State media eventually said this was because the government was restructuring its ministries, but it's also because there have been media reports about children becoming addicted, sometimes using their parents' life savings to buy video game upgrades.
Children do not have good self-control and can easily get addicted to video games, and the screens are harmful to the eyes.
That's Ms. Chen. She's worried about official retaliation against her, so won't give her full name, even though she supports tighter government control over video games. She says her grandson is only 2, but is always trying to play games on her cell phone. Meanwhile, Tommy Yuan is turning to overseas markets. His firm has published a game about surviving a zombie apocalypse on Google Play, a platform blocked in China. He's now testing a different version for Japan. He still has one game waiting for a green light from Chinese regulators, who have recently started approving new games after a 9-month pause. In Beijing, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Miller Coors, the big brewing company, is about to learn about the Streisand effect. It's suing Anheuser-Busch InBev over that ad campaign that AB InBev debuted during the Super Bowl, the one saying Miller uses corn syrup in its beers. First of all, hadn't everybody pretty much forgotten about those ads, right? And second of all, the Streisand effect? Google Devin Nunes Cow and Streisand. You'll get it. All right, we got to go. Nifty day on Wall Street today is all I've got time for. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. Props to Eve Epstein, by the way, for the numbers today, huh? I'm Colin Rosedahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.